afternoon. There's two parshiot this Shabbat. Right? It's Parshat Tetzaveh, and it's also Parshat Zachor. What was that? That's the Zachor, okay. Listen, Parshat Zachor is from the Sefer Dvarim, the end of Parshat Ketzei, and you know, these classes are not scheduled to go till Parshat. And as we mentioned last week, the material Parshat Tetzaveh is more or less repeated anyway in Parshat Pekudei, so or Vayakel also. So yes, I'd like to speak about Zachor. This is the only Kriyat Torah, as I think we mentioned in a different context a few weeks ago, which is Min HaTorah, requirement from the Torah to hear these few psukim read from a Sefer Torah once a year. According to many authorities, women are also obligated to hear this, although there's some discussion about it. Min HaTorah can be done any time during the year, but the rabbis placed it immediately before Purim, on the Shabbat before Purim, in order to draw a bit of a link between Haman, who's described as Agagi, and as we will read about in the Haftarah, Agag is king of Amalek, and therefore the rabbis sought to make such a connection, although in a few minutes we'll see whether everyone agrees to that connection. At least in its most literal understanding. In any case, if we look at the psukim regarding this mitzvah, there really are two places in the Torah where the mitzvah or the concept of Amalek and the idea of wiping out Amalek are mentioned. Of course, we have the psukim that we're going to read this Shabbat at the end of Parshat Ki Tetze. And there the Torah tells us, very, very end of Parsha Ki Tetzei, it's Dvarim Perek Chafei. The Torah tells us, Zachor, et asher asa lecha Amalek, baderech, b'tzeitchem mitzrayim. Remember, Moshe Rabbeinu is speaking in the book of Dvarim in the 40th year. And he's speaking about events that took place shortly after the exodus from Egypt. We're talking about almost 40 years previously. Many of the people to whom he was speaking were not yet born. Right? Anyone under the age of 40 was not alive then. Anyone who was, let's say, under the age of 50 or something was a child at the time. In any case, there weren't people under the age of 60 because most of the previous generation had died out. Anyone who was 20 years old or more at the Chet HaMeraglim was essentially no longer alive. So most of the people that he was speaking to had no real memory of this event, and yet he tells them Zachor. And of course, we're told also Zachor to remember something that, of course, we've never experienced ourselves either. But he says, Zachor, remember et asher asa lecha Amalek baderech b'tzeitchem mitzrayim. What did they do to you? Asher karcha baderech v'yizanev becha kol anecha shalim acharecha ve'ata ayef v'yageya. They attacked you. The word karcha, we'll talk about that word in a few minutes. They attacked you b'mikre, as it were. They surprised you, sort of randomly attacked you. Baderech. And we'll see that seems to be part of the crime. They attacked you on the road. Vayizanev mecha, from the word zanav, which means a tail. They came in from the back, where they could hit kol ha-nechesh shalim acharecha. So it's a description of an attack, not a conventional head-on military attack, but a surprise attack where they come from the rear. And assumedly, as the nation was traveling through the desert, the soldiers, those who were to protect the people, were in the front. And the Amalek attack came from the rear, sort of a surprise attack from the rear, where they hit kol ha-nechesh shalim acharecha. And it seems that they waited for the majority of the camp to pass, and they attacked only the stragglers, those who were lagging behind, who assumedly were the weak, maybe the elderly, maybe some women and children, maybe some sick people, people who were the ones who were in the back, sort of lagging behind the camp, the most vulnerable members, those who were attacked. Vata ayef v'yageya, and you were attacked when you were weary and tired, making it more difficult. V'lo yarei Elohim, and he didn't fear God. This is what he did, this terrible thing. V'haya, and therefore, v'aniach Hashem Elokech lecha mikol oivecha misaviv ba'aretz asher Hashem Elokech noten lecha nachala l'rishteh. Timche et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim lo tishkach. There's a very harsh command here. When it will come to be, and we'll talk about this condition in a moment. Baniach Hashem Elokecha lecha mikol oivecha misaviv. Ba'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha l'rishta. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to them here in the desert, a few weeks before they're going to enter the land of Canaan, and they have many battles ahead. Amalek is not the first battle. They have to establish themselves. They have to defeat the Canaanites and the other nations. But when you reach that point, then in theory your battles are all done. After you've settled down and you've defeated all the enemies and you're at peace, you still have to fight a war. Then timche et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim. And it's a very, very harsh command. The rabbis understood this to mean that the nation of Amalek has to be wiped out to the last man, woman, and child. We'll talk about that in a minute. Today we have some not such nice words for such activities. We'll raise that point in a moment. But first let's look at what the text of the Torah tells us. And lo tishkach. Don't forget, so we have Zachor and lo tishkach, and that's the mitzvah that we're going to fulfill this Shabbat, by reading these psukim in order to remember, not to forget. And sort of paradoxically, we're commanded to timche et zecher Amalek. We have to wipe out all memory of them, even as we don't forget and always remember what they did to us. So that's the mitzvah. A mitzvah which, by the way, the Rambam tells us, needs to be fulfilled at a certain point in time. The Rambam tells us at the beginning of Hilchot Melachim that there are three mitzvot that have to be done in a certain sequence. I'm sorry, it's not at the beginning of Hilchot Melachim. It is at the beginning. I'm sorry. Yes, the Rambam at the very beginning of Hilchot Melachim. Oh no, I took the wrong volume. Excuse me, just one. At the beginning of Hilchot Melachim, Perek Aleph, the Rambam, very first halacha in Hilchot Melachim, the Rambam tells us, Shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael b'shat knisatam la'aretz. There were three things that Am Yisrael had to do when they entered the land of Israel. Limnot le'melech, first to appoint a king. And then lachrid zar'o shel Amalek. Then after they have a king, they have to wipe out Amalek. And then livnot lehem beit ha'bechira. And then they have to build a beit ha'mikdash. And he tells us that minui melech kodim l'milchemet Amalek. Hachratat zarech Amalek kodemet l'vinyan ha'bayit. That these three mitzvot have to be done in sequence. Each one is a prerequisite for the other. And in fact, we find that this is what happened. Okay, they came in with Yoshua. There was a lengthy delay during the time that's described in the book of Shoftim. And only in the time of Shaul, several hundred years later, did we have a king. Shaul was the first king. Shaul, his first battle was to defeat the Plishtim, which were perhaps the last major threat. And then he was told to defeat Amalek, and as we know, and we'll talk about in a few minutes, that's and as we'll read about also in the Haftarah, this was a mitzvah that Shaul only partially fulfilled. Actually, almost completely fulfilled, but not completely. A mitzvah that perhaps David almost finished for Shaul. That Shaul was told after not defeating, this is what we'll read this Shabbat, Shaul was told after not completely defeating Amalek, that he was going to lose the kingdom. The one who's appointed in his place, of course, is David. That we read about in the beginning of, or in the middle of Shmuel Aleph. At the very end of the book of Shmuel Bet, Rav Meidan pointed out that there's a juxtaposition here. At the very end of the book of Shmuel Bet, when David was hiding out with Achish Melech Gat and was living in the town of Tziklag, pretty much at the very time that Shaul was fighting his final battle against the Plishtim in the Gilboa, the battle where Shaul would ultimately be killed, David was fighting against Amalek. Those who learn Sefer Shmuel Bet might remember that David initially was taken along to fight against, with the Plishti forces, to fight against Shaul. He didn't really want to do such a thing. And he was essentially spared from it because the other, although Achish, the king that was giving him refuge, trusted him, the other Plishtim didn't trust him. It seems that they were probably correct in not trusting him. They believed that he was still loyal to Am Yisrael, and therefore they sent him back. So David went back to Tziklag, and in the meantime, all the women and children, including his own wives, had been taken captive by Amalek. We'll talk about that also in a few minutes. And David then had to go and fight to get back all the captives, and he wound up killing out pretty much all the Amalekim that were there. And Rav Meidan pointed out the tragic contrast, that Shaul lost his kingdom because he didn't finish the war against Amalek. And as Shaul was being killed by the Plishtim, David was finishing that which Shaul hadn't done. And then, of course, it's David who begins the process of the Beit HaMikdash, a process that David began and which was completed by his son Shlomo. So, in fact, these three stages happen there, right? First, the appointment of a king, Shaul. Then, after all the other enemies defeated, the war against Amalek, started by Shaul, finished or almost finished by David. I say almost finished because that'll depend on whether Haman was also from Amalek. And then David and Shlomo building the Beit HaMikdash. I think, though, there are two major questions that we have to ask about this mitzvah. The real question, the major question, is one that I will try to address, but I tell you right now I don't have an answer for. And that's the moral question that's raised by this mitzvah. We're told to wipe out an entire nation, man, woman, and child. Today we call that, I think, genocide. I think that's the word. And it's a very, very, very difficult concept to grapple with. Now, it's a concept that we need to grapple with on the theoretical level. Already thousands of years ago, our rabbis told us that there's no practical ramification to this law any longer because we cannot identify, if there are any Amalekim left, we cannot identify them. So it's not as if any of us is expected directly to find themselves in a position where we'd be asked to act on this law. But at the same time, it's easier to talk about something with theoretical ramifications than practical ones, but if we take the Torah seriously, this needs to bother us just the same. And it seems that this is part of what bothered Shaul as well. There's been some speculation as to why Shaul didn't fully carry out the command. But at least some of the sources seem to, and I'll read you one in a few minutes, maybe even two, we'll see, seem to feel that Shaul was bothered by the moral dimension of the matter. So we'll come back to that. But that's certainly the big question, and I don't really have an answer for it, and I don't pretend to have an answer for it. I do think we need to grapple with it, though, and that's what I'd like to try to do in the next few minutes. But perhaps to grapple with that question may help to ask a second question. And through addressing the second question, perhaps we can get at least part of the way towards addressing the big question. And the second question is, even if it's necessary to wipe out an entire nation, why is it that of all of our enemies, that Amalek is given this status of being the arch enemy, the only one of our enemies? There's a similar command with regard to the seven nations of Canaan. There also, we're supposed to more or less wipe them out completely, but there are distinctions between them, and Amalek still stands in a special status. It's only Amalek that we read about every year, and that we have a biblical mitzvah to remember every single year. And if we look at, okay, Amalek attacked us, it's true, but if you look at our enemies throughout history, even throughout the time of the history discussed by the Torah and later on by the Tanakh, so there are others. So Mitzrayim, it seems about Mitzrayim. I mean, what did Amalek do, Sach HaKol? In the end of the day, they were a band of pirates who attacked us in the desert and tried to... They did. It was a terrible thing. I'm not minimizing it. But if you compare that to what the Egyptians did to us for hundreds of years of slavery, if you compare that to some of the other major enemies we had, the Plishtim, and later on Aram, and Ashur, and Bavel, and later in history, of course, Rome... Amalek? They're the ones? Even in the time covered by the Torah, for example, we had other unprovoked attacks. In the book of Bamidbar, we have a Kna'ani Melech Arad who comes and attacks Am Yisrael without any particular reason. Maybe he felt threatened. But certainly, Amalek didn't do all that much damage. And if there is someone who's going to be singled out as the arch enemy and the one who's, you know, needs to be completely wiped off the face of the earth, it's a little bit difficult to understand why Amalek. And it's the destruction of Amalek that's a prerequisite for the building of the Beit HaMikdash, Ad Kedei Kach. So this needs some understanding. Perhaps we can begin to understand this if we compare the Pesukim that we just read here in Dvarim, to the other place in the Torah where Amalek is mentioned, also in a very short passage, in the book of Shemot, where the war that's being referred to here is actually described. So if we go back to the book of Shemot, to Parsha Bishalach, just a few weeks ago we read it in the Parsha, the very end of Parshat Bishalach, we have the following description. Again, it's also only really a few psukim. Seven, eight psukim. Vayavo Amalek. I'm sorry. Perek Yud Zayin Pasuk Chet. I'm sorry. Vayavo Amalek. Vayilachem in Yisrael Berfidim. Am Yisrael was camped in a place called Refidim. And this is after they had received the water from the rock. And Amalek came and fought with them. Vayomer Moshe el Yehoshua, b'char lanu anashim etzei hilachem b'amalek machar, anochi nitzav arosh ha-giva u'mateh ha-elohim b'yadi. Moshe tells Yehoshua, we have to fight, we've been attacked, get an army together, and I'm going up to the hill. And this is where Moshe has this sort of miraculous role. Vayas Yehoshua kasher amar lo Moshe lihilachem b'amalek, u'moshe aharon v'chur alu rosh ha-giva. There was this miraculous sort of situation. Whenever Moshe raised his hands, Am Yisrael was victorious. If he put his hands down, Amalek was, regained their strength. It's not easy to hold one's hands up that way. Moshe's arms, with the assistance of Aaron and Hur, were held up so that the army would win the war. And in fact, Vayachalosh Yehoshua et Amalek ve et Amo lefi Chareb. Vayachalosh. I remember hearing once upon a time from Rav Amital Zatzal, who read carefully and noticed that it doesn't say that Yehoshua defeated Amalek. Vayachalosh Yehoshua et Amalek. He weakened them and allowed them to, and got rid of the immediate threat. But if Amalek is not completely wiped out, it just means you're kicking the can down the road, and it's going to come back. So because Yehoshua only weakened Amalek, so Shaul had to finish the job. Because Shaul didn't finish the job, David, and perhaps after David, Haman, and Vayachalosh Yehoshua et Amalek. So that's the historical description of what took place. And it's to those events that the Torah refers in the midst of Zachor et Asher Asalech Amalek. But here as well, in Shemot, there's also a few psukim that discuss the concept of this eternal war against Amalek and the requirement to remember it. But here it's described a little differently. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, k'tov zod zikaron basefer v'sim be'aznei Yehoshua. Moshe is told, write this down and keep this for posterity. Give it to Yehoshua, the leader of the next generation. Ki macho emcha et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim. Because I'm going to wipe them out. Vayiven Moshe Mizbeach. Moshe built a Mizbeach. Vayikra Shmo Hashem Nisi Vayomer. And he said, Ki Yad Al Kes Ya Milchama L'Hashem Ba'amalek Midor Dor. And he built this Mizbeach and he wrote this Sefer as a testimony with an oath. An oath, literally God's, the hand on the seat of the throne of God. An oath that there's a Milchama L'Hashem Ba'amalek Midor Dor. An eternal war between God and Amalek forever. So here in Shemot, there's no description actually of what Amalek did that's so terrible. I mean, it says that there was an attack. It says an unprovoked attack. It says that there was a war to defeat them. It says that they weakened Amalek and at least won the battle. And here, without any real description, there's this eternal war against Amalek. And the concept of Amalek ultimately being wiped out, Michiat Zecher Amalek, the wiping out of all vestiges of Amalek. But there's a big difference between the war in Shemot and the war in Dvarim. Because who's fighting the war in Shemot? What does it say here? Hashem tells Moshe, write this down, Ki macho emche et Zecher Amalek. I, God says, I will wipe out all memory of Amalek. Milchama Lashem ba'amalek. Whereas in Dvarim, it is we who are commanded, Timche et Zeich Amalek. We must do the work. And therefore what that means is that the war that we're commanded in Dvarim is actually God's war. It's not really a war between Am Yisrael and Amalek. We were attacked by the Plishtim. Maybe they wanted our land. We were attacked by various empires, the Aram and Ashur and Bavel. They wanted to rule over us. We were enslaved by the Egyptians. Okay. Those are all battles between nations. And those great empires made the mistake, perhaps, of starting up with God's people. So they get punished in the end. But this is not a war, ultimately, between Am Yisrael and Amalek. It's a milchama l'shem ba'amalek. And God makes this promise. Ultimately, I will wipe out Amalek. Because there's an eternal war. Milchama l'shem ba'amalek midor dor. It's as if there's this eternal struggle with God on one side and Amalek on the other. And we are commanded, therefore, to fight that battle. Timcha et zecher Amalek mitachat ha-shamayim. After you defeat your enemies, you can't deal with Amalek. You can't fight God's wars while you're still under attack yourself. And therefore, you are obligated to first fight your enemies, get settled. Vaya baniach Hashem Elokecha lecha mikol oyvecha misaviv. You're obligated to appoint a king to rule over you. According to the Rambam, you're obligated. Others disagree with that. But in any case, you're supposed to get to the situation that you have a stable country, a stable nation, settled in your land, not under any threats. And then you can go about fulfilling your mission. What's your mission? Now that you fought your wars, now it's time to fight God's wars. So then you go and timche et zecher Amalek. You go and carry out that which I promised I was going to do. And when you do that, then you're ready to build a Beit HaMikdash. Then you're ready to bring my presence down among you. Okay, so perhaps there's some explanation as to what makes Amalek so significant, but we haven't really explained what they did that was so terrible. Meaning, I understand that all the other enemies are our enemies, and Amalek is, or maybe God's enemies indirectly, but Amalek is fundamentally God's enemy. But what did Amalek do to show that they're God's enemy? In the end of the day, what exactly did they do? In Shemot, it doesn't tell us. It just says, Vayavo Amalek. We read these psukim, by the way, in Purim morning. This is the Kriyat HaTorah on Purim, during Shacharit, before the Megillah. Again, to draw the connection between Haman and Amalek. And it says, Vayavo Amalek Vayilachem. They came and they fought. But if we go back to Dvarim, there the Torah gives more of an explanation as to what's going on here. And there are a few keys in Amalek, in Dvarim, to try to understand what's so significant, what they did that was viewed as so terrible. First of all, Rashi, quoting the Midrash, picks up on the word karcha baderech. It's a well-known Rashi. And he quotes, as Rashi often does, it's based on a Midrash Chazal. And essentially it's based on a play on words. The word karcha comes from the word mikre. He attacks you randomly on the way. But of course, you could also read the word as from the word kar, which means cool or cold. So Rashi says, first he quotes the actual meaning that it's Lashon Mikra, and then he quotes also a separate, second Midrashic meaning, and then he says, Davar Acher, Lashon Kor Vachom. It's to be understood Midrashically, homiletically, as he cooled you down. What does that mean? Sinancha behefshircha miritichatcha. He cooled you down from you were boiling. Shehayu kol ha'umot yireim lihi lachem bachem. Uva zeh vihitchil v'hera makom la'acherim. Mashal la'ambati rotachat. She'ein kol beria yichola lirei betocha. Ba ben blial achad kafatz v'irad betocha. Af al pi she'nichve hikra uta b'fnei acherim. He says, what did Amalek do that was so terrible? We came out of Mitzrayim, and everyone was afraid of us. The entire world was afraid of us. We talk about it in Shirat Hayam. Bnei Israel stood there after the Mitzrayim had drowned in the sea, and they talked about, Tipol aleihem emata vafacha, begdol zorach hayinmu ka'aven. All the nations of the world were terrified of Am Yisrael. Aznuv halu alfei adom, elei Moav yochazemo ra'ad, namobu kol yoshvei Chanaan. All the nations were terrified by what had been seen. And nobody would have started up with Am Yisrael. Until Amalek came and cooled us down. And he gives a mashal. Let's say there's a pool of boiling hot water. Nobody would dare to jump into the water because it's too hot. Until one guy jumps in, so he gets burnt. But in the process, he cools the water down. And everyone else is able to come in afterwards. That's what Rashi says, one of the Midrashic readings of Asher Karcha Baderech. Amalek broke the taboo. Nobody would have dared to start up with Am Yisrael. And Amalek, you know, broke the taboo. And once they did it, others felt it was possible as well. Now, I read this Rashi many times. And I never saw it as something that really addresses the question that we're asking right now, which is, what did Amalek do that was so terrible? Okay, perhaps, if you want to look at it sort of in military terms, you know, or maybe geopolitical terms would be a better way to say it. So it could be that the Egyptians and later on the Plishtim, for example, were a much stronger threat, but ultimately it should be traced back to Amalek because they're the ones who broke the taboo. Had Amalek not done that, perhaps nobody would have done it. Perhaps we would have gone into Eretz Canaan much more smoothly and nobody would have opposed us. But I saw Nachama Leibovitz, who reads this Rashi, and she sees something much more fundamental here than just that. And she sees something that can perhaps begin to address the whole idea of Milchama Lashem Ba'amalek. Because it's not just about, we said already, it's not that Amalek is an enemy of Am Yisrael. Amalek is an enemy of God. And it's not just that by attacking Am Yisrael first, so they made it perhaps a little bit easier for others to attack us later on. But rather, it's much more than that. Because Am Yisrael, we talked about this a number of times in previous parshio. We talked about this back in Sefer Bereishit regarding Avraham and the other Avot, and we talked about it, I think, also maybe with Matan Torah, or certainly with the Yitziat Mitzrayim. We talked about the idea that Am Yisrael represents something. Am Yisrael has a message, right? Am Yisrael is Mamlechet Kohanim VeGoy Kadosh. Am Yisrael represents Hashem. And had, for example, Amalek not attacked us, and had Am Yisrael been, you know, had everyone continued to be afraid of Am Yisrael, the message of Yitziat Mitzrayim, what was the message of Yitziat Mitzrayim? Yadu Mitzrayim Keni Hashem. Right? The whole message, Am Yisrael came out of Mitzrayim and God's power was revealed. And the truth that Am Yisrael represents was revealed. And the falsehood of what Mitzrayim represented, the idolatry, the paganism, was debunked. And the fear the people had for Am Yisrael was the fear of God. That's what it really was. And it's that Amalek attacked, Asher Karcha Baderech. It's not just that things would have been smoother for us. That's not the point. But the world held us in such reverence because they saw what we represented. No one dared to start up to us because the truth that had been revealed in the 10 plagues, and particularly in Kriyat Yam Suf, the truth that Am Yisrael saw when they sang that song and said, the whole world is trembling. And a few weeks later, with a voice that came down on Sinai, was supposed to be heard by the entire world. But in between, somebody came and burst that bubble. Somebody came and challenged it and said, what are you so afraid of? I'm not afraid. We'll go attack them. And that represented kfira. That represented a denial of everything that Am Yisrael represents. And it gave others the strength to do the same. And so that's the beginning of understanding why it's a milchama l'shem b'amalek. And then the Nachama Leibovitz goes further and says there's something interesting about the way it's described here. First of all, there's some descriptions about what the nature of the attack was. In Shmot, it doesn't tell us. It just tells us vayavo amalek vayilachem. It doesn't tell us why they attacked and it doesn't tell us how they attacked. But here it is told to us. It's told to us that they came baderech, as the people were traveling, that they came from the rear, that they attacked the weak. And it seems, therefore, that Amalek, first of all, was not... Amalek was a desert tribe of nomads in the desert. This was not, had one of the nations of Canaan, like the king of Arad, who later attacked us, had he sent forces to attack us now, there might have been some understanding of that. I mean, they felt threatened, the people of Canaan, with good reason. And assumedly they knew where we were headed. And had one of the nations of Canaan decided, you know, I'm going to take the battle over there and not wait for them to come to me, we're going to try to defeat them, it could have been viewed as some sort of attempted self-defense, or even later on when the great empires came, right, and attacked us. So I'm not saying this is necessarily a moral thing to do, but this is imperialism. Nations want to rule the world and conquer other nations. It's part of the normal functioning of human society, for better or for worse. This was something completely different. These people, these Amalekim who lived down in the desert and made their living, they're pirates basically, who make their living by attacking the weak and the defenseless. Rav Maidan had developed in a number of places the understanding that they were actually slave traders. We see that later on with David. They attacked, remember, when David was on his way to fight with Shaul, to fight against Shaul, he thought, with the Plishtim. So all the men left and the women and children were behind in Siklag. And then when they came back, they found that Siklag had been raided by the Amalekim, and the Amalekim had taken everybody. But then David went and managed to rescue everyone who had been taken. That means they didn't kill anybody. They attacked the city. They didn't let the people go, but they didn't kill them either. They captured all the women and children alive. Why? Because they were planning to sell them as slaves. That's what they were doing. So they're a nation whose entire existence is preying on the weak and defenseless for their own benefit. And there's a particular expression that's used here that Nechama Leibovitz points out. It says here, "Velo yare," again in Dvarim, "Velo yare Elokim." They didn't fear God. And it turns out that the phrase "Yirat Elokim" appears a number of times in the Torah prior to this, always in the same context. For example, all the way back in Bereshit, in the time of Abraham. So if you remember, Abraham's wife was taken from him twice, first by Paro and later by Avimelech. Right? And he had this thing where he tells people when he travels that she's his sister. And so when he came to Avimelech, so Avimelech took, this is Bereshit Perek Chaf, Avimelech took Sarah, thinking she was a single woman, and he found out that she was a married woman. He found out because God came to him in a dream and said, don't touch her, and you know, you better give her back, and you better, etc. So the next day he did. He brought her back to Abraham, and he sort of rebuked Abraham. He said, you know, why did you mislead me? Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? I wouldn't have started up. It's your fault. Blame the victim, right? So how does Abraham respond to that? Abimelech said to him, I'm reading from Bereshit Perek Chaf, Pasuk Yud, and then Yud Aleph. Ayom Abimelech el Avraham, ma ra'ita ki asit et hadavar hazeh? Why didn't you tell me? Ayom Abraham ki amarti, rak ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh, v'haraguni al dvar ishti. I was afraid that if I told you she was my wife, you would have said, well, we can't take a married woman, we're moral people, we don't do that. So we have a simple solution, though. We can change that fact. Right now she's a married woman, but there's ways around. There's ways to solve that problem, and you would have killed me. And now, why was I afraid you would have killed me? Because I saw that ein yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh. There's no yirat Elohim here. Also, later on, also in the book of Bereshit, Yosef. Yosef, who, of course, was a member of Am Yisrael, but when he was speaking to his brothers before they knew who he was, when he was acting the role as if he was an Egyptian, and speaking, therefore, the way an Egyptian would have spoken in order to maintain his, disguise, I guess. So, this is... it's a Parshat Miketz. Yosef, you know, set up the whole story with the cup in order to, so to speak, entrap Binyamin. And after, you know, the brothers believed, at least, that Binyamin had been caught with the stolen cup. So So he says, I'm keeping Binyamin here. Right? I'm going to read from Perek Membet, Pasuk Tadvav. Again, Yosef is speaking as if he was an Egyptian. And he says, Bazoti bachenu chei paron tetsu mizekim bivo achichem akaton hena. Oh, I'm sorry. This is before that. He wants them to send his brother. So he says, you'll send one, right? He locked them all up. He said, I think you're spies. I'm sorry, it's before the cup. I was confused. But he locked them all up. And he said, you'll send one person to go get your brother and prove to me that you're telling the truth. And then he said, you know what? He put them in jail for 3 days. And then he said to him, you know what? I'm going to be nice to you. I'm not going to keep all of you as prisoners. I'm going to keep just one of you as prisoners, and the rest of you can go home and get your brother. And why am I going to do that? Because I'm a moral person. I'm not unreasonable. I have suspicion. I'm afraid you're spies. I want to see if your story is true. You claim you have another brother. I want to see it. I'm keeping one person here as a hostage, because I'm a moral person. I'm not going to lock all of you up for no reason. After all, he says, and this is the point, I fear God, and therefore, I'm going to do, you know, the right thing. So you see that same expression. Abraham said to Avimelech, "Ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh." I was afraid that you would kill me because I saw there's no fear of God. Yosef, when he wants to show that he's reasonable, again, speaking not as a Jew, but as an Egyptian, says he fears God. And at least one other place. In the beginning of the book of Shemot, we have the Miyaldot, right? The midwives who were commanded by Paro to do that horrific thing, to kill all the baby boys. Now, they're called Miyaldot HaIvriot, Shifra and Pua. And I'm sure many are familiar with the Midrashic idea that these were actually Miriam and Yocheved. But not everyone agrees to that idea. That's one idea in the Midrash. And there are those who believe that these Miyaldot not only were not Miriam and Yocheved, but were not actually Jewish at all. They're called Miyaldot HaIvriot. So that could mean that they are midwives who are Ivriot. They are from the nation of the Ivrim. Or it could just be that they are the Miyaldot of the Ivriot, the ones who served as the midwives for the women. And there are some who understand that these are actually Egyptian women who defied the command of Paro just because they were decent people and they weren't going to go ahead and kill all these babies. And what does it say about them? It says, "Vatirena hamiyaldot et ha'elohim, v'lo asu kasher tzivalihem melech Mitzrayim, v'techayena et ha'yiladim." They're also described, even if they're not Jewish, with the expression that they acted morally because they feared God. And therefore what we see is that the expression Yirat Elohim, at least in the books of Bereishit and Shemot, means sort of a universal type of understanding that there are certain things that just aren't done. I heard once from Rav Moshe Lichtenstein also a similar idea regarding the book of Yonah. In Yonah, you'll remember that Yonah was running away, and there was this terrible storm, and Yonah told them, okay, it's my fault, if you want to solve the problem, throw me overboard, and the storm will stop. That's what he told them to do. He said, throw me overboard, kill me. He's volunteering, it's my fault, throw me overboard. Kill me, and the problem will be solved. And they didn't want to do it. The sailors on the boat, who it already says each prayed to his god, these were idolaters, they each prayed to his god, and they didn't want to do it. They tried, they said, okay, we're not going to do that. So they tried desperately to save the ship. They tried all rowing back to shore, and they saw it wasn't working. They saw that they were about to die. And only when they realized they had absolutely no choice did they throw Yonah overboard, and immediately the storm stopped. So essentially they saw that, in fact, this was correct. And it says, Vayiru hanashim yirah gedolah et Hashem. And Rav Moshe Lichtenstein also, there it doesn't use the phrase Yirat Elokim, it's a little different. But he said this, you see the same thing here. These were idolaters. These weren't religious people who, these weren't, you know, the B'nai Noach who, or the Chassidei Umot HaOlam who recognized that this wasn't Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem in the time of Abraham, and it wasn't Yitro in the time, right? These were just plain people who worship idols. They're pagans. But they don't throw innocent people into the ocean. You just don't do that. You just don't throw a man overboard. That's called Yirat Elokim. Basic human decency, basic human... Menschlichkeit, even more than just Menschlichkeit. Like, you don't do certain things. You don't murder innocent babies. You don't throw people overboard. You don't kill men and to take their wives. You don't do things like that. That's called Yirat Elokim. And Amalek, lo yare Elokim. It's not just that Amalek fought a war. They fought a war that's like beneath all moral standards. Right? They preyed on the weak and the defenseless. And had no regard for human beings. Anything that could put a few dollars in their pocket, they're willing to do. It's that attitude, it's that philosophy that's described as lo yare Elokim. And you see this through Amalek. And you see it later on, and perhaps this is part of the reason why Haman is identified with Amalek later on. Haman was insulted by Mordechai. Okay. Mordechai didn't respect his authority, didn't respect the law. You know what? Maybe even executing Mordechai might have even been something that could be understood within the context of it. I mean, it doesn't sound like a capital offense to refuse to bow to someone, but within the mindset of the Persian Empire, maybe that could be somewhat justified. But Lashmid, Larog, Ulabed, Kol HaYudim, Minar, Ve'ad, Zakein, Taf, Nashim. In 127 countries? That's Amalek. Complete lack of proportion, complete lack of regard.
And it never says in the Megillah that he didn't fear Hashem. Is there a pasuk like that?
Is there a pasuk? Hashem's name is not even mentioned in the Megillah.
That's right. In the Megillah there's no Hashem's name.
Correct. But he is identified with Amalek by the phrase Agagi.
Uh-huh.
Right? Agag.
Yeah.
Right? Which assumedly means he was a descendant of Amalek. And it's the rabbis that are making the connection by having us read Parshat Zachor now and by having us read by Yavo Amalek and Purim morning, etc. The next comment I want to make, I have to just issue another disclaimer that I do not mean any practical ramifications to this whatsoever. But the idea that an entire society can perhaps be so evil that it's beyond repair and that it can be so far from any possibility of redemption that perhaps it has to be wiped out completely. It's an idea that I always found troubling and I still do, and we'll talk about that next. But having moved to Israel and lived here through, you know, the Second Intifada, perhaps now, if you think about ISIS as another example, the notion that there are certain things that just go beyond enemies or even beyond the ordinary sense of evil. You know, I mean, it's one thing, you know, to attack nations. You know, when Israel was declared and the Arabs, you know, tried to, when Nasser threatened to throw us into the sea, and, you know, these were not nice people. These were bitter enemies, and we tried to make peace and all this. But in the end of the day, it was a war over land, it was a war over sovereignty, it was a war, there's some, you could put it into some kind of normal categories. When you're dealing already with a situation, you know, this first occurred to me in during the Second Intifada, during the era of all the suicide bombings. You know, when you have a nation where, you know, a mother sends her son off with a kiss on the cheek to proudly wait for him to blow himself up in a pizza shop, you know, and is thrilled that her son is going to die just because he's going to kill other women and children and teenagers and whoever else happens to be in there. And you know, this, it seems to be getting worse all the time. When you get to what, you know, what we're seeing now with that, I'm sorry? Where?
Nigeria.
With a Boko, with that group?
Yeah. In Africa.
right? And the type of things, you know, when the type of things, the horrific things that ISIS is doing with these videos, when Hassan Nasrallah can say about them they're crazy, it begins the concept that humanity has the capacity at some point to reach the stage that maybe there is no redemption possible. Again, I'm not suggesting that we draw any practical conclusions by labeling groups as Amalek and acting accordingly. I'm not saying such a thing, and I don't want to be misunderstood as suggesting that I am. But it began to have started to resonate with me a little bit differently. But still, in the end of the day, it's still very hard to swallow the concept that we're commanded to. I mean, we're talking about people who murder babies, and therefore the solution is to kill babies. And that's what we're being told here.
You're saying an eye for an eye. What do you say?
Perhaps. So let me now tell you about Shaul. There's some speculation, both among classic commentaries and among some of the more modern commentaries also. You know, why didn't Shaul do what he was told? He was told to kill Adamelech completely. In the end, he left one man alive, not a baby even. Sounds like he killed the babies. Seems that way. It even says so, if I remember correctly. Right, he saved some of the animals, and he saved the king. And there's all kinds of speculation. I'll look at it later. There's all kinds of speculation as to why he did it, and some suggested even maybe political motives or the idea. He said that he kept the animals alive in order to bring them as korbanot, maybe. Some have speculated maybe he was planning to kill Agag also. He just wanted to do it in some kind of public ceremony or something, you know, bring the king as the last. But at least according to some of the Midrashim, that's not what was going on through Shaul's head. And I'm reading to you now from the Yalkut Shimoni. There's a very version of the same discussion in the Gemara in Yoma as well. It says, Vayavo Shaul al-ir Amalek vayarev banachal. He camped in the nachal, in the wadi, in the riverbed. And the Midrash picks up on that word and says, al-iske nachal. I'm a Ravmani al-iske nachal. That he was talking about something that has to do with a nachal. What's that? B'sha'a she'amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shaul, lech v'hikit et Amalek. Amar hashta, u'ma al nefesh achat mi'Yisrael amrat Torah havei egla arufa banachal. Kol nefashot ha'ila kulan al achat kama v'kama. The Midrash connects the word nachal with another place in the Torah where this word appears, regarding the mitzvah of egla arufa. Egla arufa, I don't have time to look up the psukim right now, but egla arufa, I'll just tell you outside, right? We have this mitzvah in the book of Devarim also. If God forbid, a person is found on the road between two villages or two cities, murdered. An unsolved murder, and we don't know who did it. There's a murder. You know, you can see signs of violence on the body. Someone was walking on the road and was killed. So there's a mitzvah where you have to measure and find the city that's closest to the scene of the crime. And there's this ceremony called Egla Arufa. You take a calf, and goes out, a young calf, and you go out to the nearest nachal, the nearest riverbed, and you break the neck of the calf and kill this animal. And the elders of the city have to come out and wash their hands and say, Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh. Our hands did not shed this blood. And it's meant to sort of impress upon the people. No one thinks really that the elders of the city are the ones who murdered him, but it's meant to show that maybe they have some degree of guilt. Maybe he came into town and he was traveling alone and they didn't make sure that he was taken care of. Maybe he went out, maybe people didn't invite him into their homes and therefore the victim continued on his way and was, or maybe they didn't give him an escort. They should have realized that somebody's traveling alone. He needs some kind of protection. In other words, there's some collective responsibility here. And this is meant to sort of shock the people and make them realize that, you know, human life is not to be taken lightly. So Vayarev Banachal, midrashically, Shaul, it's read here as he fought with God about the Nachal. And the Midrash puts these words into Shaul's mouth. He said to God, according to the homiletic idea here, you want me to wipe out Amalek? Al nefesh achat, according to one, if even one person is killed, you said we have to have this whole ceremony. Kol nefesh, and right? It's such a terrible thing if one innocent person is killed that we have to have this whole ceremony in the Nachal? And now you want me to go and kill an entire nation? And even if im adam chata, even if I can somehow understand that the people sin, he doesn't deal with the children, but beimama chata. Oh, he does. I'm sorry. He does deal with the children in this version. Right? You want me to kill animals too? What do the animals do? Im gdolim chatu, if the adults sinned, ktanim mechatu. You want to tell me to kill the men, maybe the women, adults who are, maybe. But animals, babies? Yatzta bat kol de'amra lo al tihi tzadik harbe. So first of all, uvishash amar ledoeg sov upagaba kohanim, yatzta bat kol de'amra lo al tirsha harbe. There's two messages in this midrash. First of all, the idea that Shaul was motivated not by some kind of political calculation or whatever, but that Shaul's hesitancy to completely carry this out was actually due to a moral concern. And Shaul couldn't bring himself to do it. He said, how can I do such a thing? How can I wipe out an entire nation without any discrimination between who might be guilty, who might not be guilty, even children, even animals? And there's a divine response. Al tihi tzadik harbe. Don't think you're so righteous. Later on, Shaul wound up wiping out the city of Nov. Later on, when Shaul was desperately trying, futilely trying to prevent David from becoming the king, and he believed incorrectly that the Kohanim in the city of Nov, where the Mikdash had been at that time, the Mishkan, he believed incorrectly that they had provided some assistance to David in his rebellion against Shaul, he wiped out the entire city. And we learned this a few years ago, and if you remember, we saw how the Psukim make parallels to the way in which we're supposed to deal with Amalek. So Shaul, who couldn't bring himself to wipe out the Amalekim, wound up wiping out the Kohanim of Nov, and Hashem said to him there, don't be so righteous, and here said to him, don't be so evil. And later on, this Midrash makes the following statement. Vayachmol Shaul ve'ha'am al Hagag. They had mercy on Hagag. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Koshu Rachman al Achzari, Lisof nase Achzar al Rachmanim. He who has mercy against the cruel people will eventually be cruel to the merciful people. And connects it also to what Shaul did to the Kohanim of Nov. So I don't have a real reconciliation here. But I do have two things. First of all, at the very least, even if we have to carry this out, apparently it's supposed to bother us. And the great King Shaul, this was his downfall. His downfall was that it bothered him. And the message is that perhaps there are things that are beyond our understanding. And again, without making too close of a connection, the historians often hypothesize, what if you could go, or historians or philosophers of history, what if you could go back in a time machine to the time when Adolf Hitler was a little baby, right? And could you just, what would have happened if somebody would have put a bullet in that child's head? Of course, no one could have known then, right? But it's an interesting hypothetical question. If you could have known, would it be moral, etc.? And it's also a historical question, how much of it was really one man, how much of it would have happened anyway, but the idea that there are things that are, so evil that sometimes extreme measures need to be taken. I certainly don't think anybody would suggest, and the rabbis aren't suggesting either, the rabbis have made very clear that this mitzvah does not apply practically nowadays, but I have just one more point to make about that. But the idea that, perhaps when fighting certain types of enemies, the ethics of war need to be, recalibrated. And tactics, all the concern with civilian casualties, etc. It could be that when fighting certain types of enemies, certain types of decisions have to be made that otherwise might not be made. And the exact practical applications of that, of course, are much more complicated. But I think there's a powerful thought there. And I'll just close with this. Rav Soloveitchik made a famous remark, which he quoted in the name of his father. In the book of in the Rambam, Hilchot Malachim, he talks about the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek, and the similar but different mitzvah that I mentioned, also to wipe out the seven nations of Canaan. When it comes to the seven nations of Canaan, the Rambam makes the comment that although there's a mitzvah to wipe them out at all times and in all places, that mitzvah no longer has any practical ramification because they've intermarried with the other nations and essentially they're lost from history. So the Rambam records the mitzvah to wipe out the seven nations and comments that this mitzvah still theoretically applies but no longer has any practical ramifications. In the next halacha, the Rambam talks about the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek and does not make such a comment. Does not point out that even though the rabbis say that about Amalek as well. And Rav Soloveitchik therefore suggested, there's some discussion about whether he meant this in an actual halachic sense or whether he meant this only as a midrashic or philosophical idea, that the war against Amalek never ends, and that whereas the other nations are genealogical categories, that Amalek is not. And that anyone who acts like Amalek, any nation that acts like Amalek, actually has a halach of Amalek, and he specifically brought the Nazis into this context as well. The Talmud Yerushalmi, by the way, and this is why I didn't get a chance to get into, but according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, it's not clear that Haman was actually descendant of Agag. The Talmud's not clear on that. And it could be that the expression Agagi, referring to Haman, was not telling us about his genealogy, that he was an actual descendant, but it's labeling him as an Agagi because he acted like Amalek. Okay, and Soloveitchik said that about the Nazis. And when there were discussions in the 1950s about whether Israel should accept reparations from the Nazis, from Germany, and it was a major, very emotional battle here in Israel as to whether we should accept such money or not, Rav Soloveitchik came out against it. He said that when you fight Amalek, you're not allowed to take bizah, you're not allowed to take spoils of war. And he felt that we shouldn't have accepted the... I'm not taking a position on that matter, but I'm just showing you. So Rav Soloveitchik felt that Amalek represents an ideology and a philosophy, and even perhaps halachically, that when Am Yisrael is attacked by such an enemy, that the laws of Amalek, on some level apply, or at least that this mitzvah applies. We haven't solved the problem, but perhaps we've shed some light on the grappling with it.